We are getting started a couple minutes late. You guys are here in-house. Have that in front of you for lesson 238, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text. We're going to start looking this morning at the 1638 Cambridge edition. If you're joining us right now online and you would like to follow along with the notes, please go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down here under Recent Sermons, and click on the lesson for September 15, lesson 238, and you'll be able to load the notes and follow along as we go through this material. So let me just get this up, because I will be needing to show some things here, okay? So again, this is lesson 238, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, the 1638 Cambridge edition. So let's get right into the introduction. In lesson 237, we used Job 4:6 to frame a discussion of the printed history of the Authorized Version text during the 1630s. After doing so, we came to the following conclusion. So these are some summary points of what we saw last Sunday in lesson 237. Number one, the textual history of Job 4:6 in the Cambridge printings is an example of both a printer's error. Remember that one of them left off the word this. The other one had the word this in italics, and this is in the 1629 folio edition, and an editorial change related to the placement of the word and the phrase thy hope. So we looked at that. Remember that originally and thy hope was at the end of the verse, and then over time they relocated some of that information back to the center of the verse. Okay. Number two, the Cambridge did not print the text with uniformity during the period in question. I showed you clearly that they had, that there was some editions that were printed throughout the 1630s. There was a reprint of a folio edition that did not match what was being printed by the lesser editions during the 1630s. Number three, the London printings issued by the King's printer differed from those published by Cambridge. So now you have a difference between the Cambridge and the London printings. In the case of Job 4:6, discrepancies in the use of italics, punctuation, spelling, and word order existed between the London and Cambridge printings during the 1630s. Those of you that follow the church's YouTube channel during the week, you'll know that I put out a video Thursday doing a thought experiment of a guy, a fictitious guy that I called Sam, standing in a bookshop in London in 1630s. Which one should he buy if he wants to buy the exact words and only the exact words? Does he buy the Cambridge or does he buy the London printing? And so we kind of did a thought experiment on that. If you haven't seen that video, I would encourage you to check that out. That's from Thursday. Number four, more research is necessary to determine when the London printings issued by the King's printer conform to the editions issued by Cambridge. So I don't know how long this lasts. I know it's for at least one decade that Cambridge and London are not printing the same text. There are differences in the text between London and Cambridge. I don't know if that's just for one decade, the 1630s. I don't know if it extends into the 1640s or the 1650s. I don't know yet. It is an outstanding question that I'm trying to figure out among the other things I have going on. So this is yet another reason why demanding verbatim identicality of wording across the printed history of the King James text is not a wise position to adopt. If you're going to demand that, then you're going to have to tell Sam, who's standing in the bookshop in the 1630s, which one is the inerrant one and which one is not. This seems to me to be a position that a King James advocate or defender does not want to take. In contrast, understanding the principle of verbal equivalence mitigates this problem. So we've seen all of those points now in last week in lesson 237 as we were looking at the text in the 1630s. So in this lesson, we will begin a consideration of the 1638 Cambridge Folio Edition. So let me just say a word about that before we get right into this, okay? It has historically been the case that people that have been tracking these things viewed the folio editions as sort of the flagship editions. Those were the largest ones that were printed. The 1611 was originally printed as a folio for use in the pulpit in a church. And then over time, they released, you know, smaller editions in different sizes that would have been more for personal buying or personal study, okay? But it's typically been the case that people have traced the folios as being sort of the flagship editions or the flagship printings, all right? So let's get into the 1638 Cambridge Folio Edition. Thomas Fuller, author of The Church History of Britain from the Birth of Jesus Christ until the year 1655, that's what the Roman numerals equal there, I don't know about you, but I get too many Roman numerals and I start getting cross-eyed trying to remember what stands for what. But 1655 states the following regarding the quality of the Bibles printed at Cambridge. Mike, this also leads me right now while I'm thinking about it to note that on the works cited, there's an error. I have the wrong title there by Fuller. It should be Church History of Britain and not the History of the University of Cambridge.
The Church History of Britain.
It should be the one that's mentioned on page one. Yeah, there's an error there in the works cited that we're going to have to fix in the edited copy of the notes. Okay, so just everybody be aware of that. So he says the following regarding the quality of the Bibles printed at Cambridge. Quote, Cambridge printer, known by the dictionary of his name, heightened printing to a higher degree, since exactly complicated by his successors in that office, witness the Cambridge Bible, now watch, of none exacter or truer edition in England. So does this particular commenter who's writing in 1655 acknowledge that the most exact Bibles you can buy in England at the time were being printed by who?
Cambridge.
Okay. So there's a clue maybe to how people thought about it two decades later in the 1650s. Okay. There was a perception that Cambridge was a more accurate printer of the text than anyone else who was printing it at the time. Okay. Next point. Regarding the Cambridge edition of 1638, William Kilburn stated the following around 1660 in his Dangerous Errors in Several Late Printed Bibles to the Great Scandal and Corruption of Sound and True Religion. Top page two, he says, quote, the authentic, that's what that word means, the authentic corrected Cambridge Bible, revised Mandito Regio, by the learned Dr. Ward, Dr. Goad of Headley, Mr. Boyce, Mr. Mead, and printed by the elaborate industry of Thomas Buck Esquire and Mr. Roger Daniel. Okay. Now, all of that is referring to the 1638 Cambridge. Okay. Professor David Norton, author of A Textual History of the King James Bible, questions the reliability of some of Kilburn's statements. All right. The other thing that strikes me, Mike, that I forgot to do is Mandato Regio there should be in italics at the top, on the top line. Okay. So what he's, let's stop there. What Kilburn is saying is that the Bible that was printed by Cambridge, okay, by the learned Dr. Ward. Dr. Ward is talking about Samuel Ward. He was one of the original translators on the King James Bible, okay? Dr. Goad of Headley and Mr. Boyce. Mr. Boyce is referring to John Boyce. John Boyce was also one of the original translators. In fact, if you recall, it was John Boyce who took the notes on the general meaning that have survived history in Boyce's notes. Okay, so there are two for the 1638. We have a documentable source that says that Cambridge employed the assistance of two of the original translators on the King James Bible, notably Samuel Ward and John Boyce. Is everybody following that? Okay. Professor David Norton, author of A Textual History of the King James Bible, questions the reliability of some of Kilburn's statements. Quote, Kilburn is not always reliable. Authentic, presumably meaning perfect and authoritative, may well be his own description. So let's stop right there. So what he's saying is, what Norton is saying is that when Kilburn calls it authentic and corrected, he's suggesting that that's Kilburn's opinion. Okay? He's not, there's nothing else to suggest that that's absolutely true the way Kilburn is representing it. Does everybody understand that? Okay? Then he says, may well be his own description, and revised Mandato Regio, which means in Latin, royal mandate, cannot be confirmed. So in other words, we don't have any other extant proof that the king of the at the time ordered the 1638 Cambridge text to be corrected. Okay, he's, what Norton is saying is that these things are possibly Kilburn's opinion, because we don't have any other sources that would speak to or corroborate some of these statements that Kilburn is making. Okay, so he says, cannot be confirmed. If he did not know the 1638 edition was authorized, he certainly believed it ought to have been and should be taken as authoritative. Okay, so what Norton is saying is that unless Kilburn has some evidence that he's not talking about, he's at least stating his opinion about what the case should be regarding the 1638 Cambridge. Okay, in footnote 2 on page 22 of his The Authorized Edition of the English Bible, 1611, F.H.A. Scrivener states the following regarding Kilburn's Mandato Regio claim for the 1638. He says simply, whatever that may mean. So in other words, these guys can't find any independent corroboration of what Kilburn is saying here. Okay? So let's just stop there, see if anybody has any questions.
Of the folks making comment here, which has the better grasp? In just a general sense.
Well, I don't see any reason to think that Norton and Scrivener are misunderstanding it. They're simply pointing out that whatever he means, number one, it's not clear, and number two, we don't have any, you know, independent extant evidence to corroborate it either way.
So Kilburn's trying to basically put some flashy lights around the edition to make it a little more seemingly official.
Kilburn's piece could be taken as somewhat of a propaganda piece. Okay. But it's the best that we have extant to be able to comment on the 1638, okay? So look at the next point. Despite the unsubstantiated nature of some of Kilburn's claims, A.S. Herbert states the following regarding the 1638 Cambridge edition in his Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1525 to 1961. Quote, in this edition, thus favorable notice by Kilburn, The word of correction begun in the Folio Cambridge Bible of 1629 was carried further. This remained the standard text until the publication of Dr. Paris's Cambridge edition in 1762. So here's the thing. Some of Kilburn's statements cannot necessarily be verified. However, there is truth to the claim that after Cambridge edited this edition in 1638, this was viewed as the standard text until it was edited again until 1762 by Paris at Cambridge University once again. Okay, so look at the next point. In other words, the 1638 Cambridge Folio edition exerted a powerful influence over subsequent printings for the next 124 years, even as some of Kilburn's claims cannot be corroborated. So, maybe Kilburn's right, maybe he's not, regarding some of the claims about Mandato Regio or Royal Mandate, as well as his comments about authoritative and so forth. Okay, he does not appear though to be wrong about Boyce and Ward. So in his The Authorized Edition of the English Bible, 1611, Scrivener stated the following regarding the combined work of the Cambridge 1629 and 1638 editions. He says, quote, referring to the 1629, that it inaugurated that course of systematic revision of the text, of the italics and of the margin, which 9 years afterward was more fully and consistently carried out. The task seems to have been executed by the two sets of editors in no unequal shares. What the one party left undone by reason of haste or human oversight, the others in good measure supplied by inserting words or clauses, especially in the Old Testament, overlooked by the editors of 1611, by amending manifest errors, by rendering the italic notation at once more self-consistent and more agreeable to the design of the original translators. So what Scrivener is saying there is that the 1629 edition was a big step forward as far as consistency in the use of italics, in correcting obvious print errors and bringing stability to the text. Whatever was left undone in 1629 was completed in 1638 by the Cambridge editors. That is essentially what Scrivener is saying. Okay? So any questions or comments, just as a check-in of where we're at. Okay. top of page 3. Writing more than 100 years later, this would be 100 years after Scrivener, Professor Norton regards Scrivener's summary quoted above as a, quote, fair representation of the situation. He says on page 90, quote, "This is a fair summary," so he's referring there to Scrivener, "this is a fair summary of the combined work, and the point that these additions worked on the italics and the margin needs underlining. For the time being, I concentrate on the text, but it is important to note that any work on the italics involves close attention, here it is, to the originals to determine which words in the translation have no direct equivalent in the original language. And that the margin also required a great deal of scholarly time and attention for its development." Now, what he's saying there is this. If you are going to accurately identify italicized words, the way you're going to determine if something needs to be italicized is to compare the English against the Hebrew and the Greek. Because what the King James translators were endeavoring to do with the italics is to fill in words in English that are necessary to complete and render the verse intelligible in English that are not necessarily in the original language text. Thus, they demarcate those words and are transparent to the reader by putting those words in italics. Does that make sense? So the only way you're going to know what should be italicized and what should not is if you're comparing the English against the original language text. So what Norton's point is to say, therefore, that whatever's going on at the Cambridge Press in 1629 and 1638 is involving a close comparison of the English text with the originals, in part, not in total, to identify where words should have been in italics. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, one question that inevitably arises when discussing the 1638 Cambridge edition is related to the fact that John Boyce and Samuel Ward, two of the original translators, are stated by Kilburn to have assisted on the project. We already saw that, right? Does this mean that some of the original translators assisted on the 1629 as well? Some argue, based upon Kilburn's documentable piece, circa 1660, that the translators assisted on all of the prior printings of the authorized version. Okay? So understand what's going on here. All right, let me see if I can quickly call up the Kilburn piece online. And it looks like here it is. So the University of Michigan in their digital archives has digitized a bunch of these early English books online, okay? So here's dangerous errors in several late printed Bibles to the great scandal of corruption, Kilburn, and this is dating somewhere around 1660. They have it listed here as 1659, although I've seen it listed other places with a little bit of difference there, okay? So what I also want to do here is, I think it's on page, bear with me, right here. So here it is, the part that we quoted earlier, okay? Authentic, corrected by Cambridge, revised Mandato Regio by the learned Dr. Ward. So that's Samuel Ward, a translator, okay? And Mr. Boyce. Mr. Boyce is a translator. And notice that this is explicitly applied to the folio edition from Cambridge from what year? 1638, okay? So understand what we have here. Do we have a datable source saying that two translators worked on the 1638 Cambridge folio? That's what we have, right? It's very clear. It's talking about Cambridge, the Cambridge Bible, the folio from 1638, and that Ward and Boyce were there as part of the project. That's what it's saying, right? So here's what happens now, sort of in the argumentation of some. They'll say, well, see, they worked on this one, and they'll point to Kilburn as evidence for that. But then they'll say that proves, therefore, that they worked on the 1629 as well as the 1616 or any of the other prior printings. They were working on those or assisting somehow in those as well. And so they take the 1638 statement from Kilburn, and they sort of back apply it or back load it onto all of the previous ones and say, well, they must have been there for those two. The problem with that is, number one, we don't have a source that proves that or points in that direction. We just don't have a source that does that. So it's somewhat speculation, right? So go back to the notes. So as I said, the bottom of that second bullet point at the top, some argue based upon Kilburn's documentable piece from circa 1660 that the translators assisted on all prior printings of the AV. Well, look at the next point. While I do not like to argue from silence, there just is no extant historical evidence to substantiate these claims. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, we don't know. Okay? Moreover, as we noted in Lesson 237, it does not seem reasonable to assume that King James translators were perpetually embedded in the print shops of both London and Cambridge, advising on every printing of the text. That does not seem like a reasonable thing. Do you think that these guys had nothing better to do with the rest of their life after they were done with the translation project than to hang around print shops in London and Cambridge their entire life? That doesn't seem reasonable to me. Okay? So let's read the rest of this. Lastly, in a recent discussion regarding this topic, my friend and fellow researcher Christopher Yetzer stated the following, quote, I highly doubt that a translator was present every single time a text was reset in the 1600s, but I really have no idea. The fact that the 1638 was advertised as such makes me think that they were not always what? So what Brother Yetzer is saying is the fact that Kilburn is going out of his way to note specifically that two of them were present in 1638 would suggest that there's something unique and distinct, therefore, about 1638 compared to the prior ones. Although neither he, nor me, nor anyone else really can say definitively 100% for sure. Okay? So any questions or comments about that?
Also seems like he's also questioning the royal mandate as well, because it doesn't look like there's any evidence of that.
There is no extant evidence outside of Kilburn's statement that it was done by royal mandate. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. We just don't know at this point. Is it? So I think Yetzer makes an interesting point. Why go to the trouble of specifically noting this about 1638 about Ward and Boyce if they had assisted on all of the prior ones? There seems to be something about mentioning them in this specific year of the Cambridge Press that is designed to give it an extra sort of authority, so to speak, at least in the way.
A special edition, wasn't it?
What's that?
The 1638 folio was special in some ways. I mean,
yeah,
that's why they were present, probably.
That seems to be what Kilburn is suggesting. Sure.
But, yeah.
So look at the next point, and you guys can tell me if you agree. At the end of the day, we just don't know the level of involvement the original translators had in the editing and printing of the text before 1638. Regarding the possibility that some of the Cambridge editors worked on the 1629 folio edition as well as the 1638 folio, Scrivener states, quote, what persons were concerned in the edition of 1629, as Lee Wilson notices, we are wholly what?
Ignorant.
But if similarity of plan and spirit afford us any ground for what?
Conjecture.
At least one of them must have had a share with others in preparing the subsequent book of 1638. So he says the following, okay? First of all, are we wholly ignorant about who all was involved in the 1629?
Right.
Yeah. And he says that any ground would be a conjecture. What's a conjecture?
A supposition.
A supposition, an educated guess, so to speak, but we just don't know. Okay? Any questions there? So I'm going to just repeat. For somebody to take this statement here from Kilburn that specifically notes Ward and Boyce assisting on the folio of 1638 and then back applying that as evidence to all of the prior ones the translators had to have been involved in those too, to me is a question, is questionable at best. Okay? All right, anything else on that before we move on?
Is there any evidence, I'm just thinking in the matter of history of England, is there any evidence that there was some big push? Because, I mean, this guy seems like he's trying to sell this hard, just in my opinion, and that's why he's laying this down the way he is. Is there something else tying into to that history of the time and saying the last, you know, say 2 or 3 years prior, there was a push for maybe the lack of reading, there was a push for lack of sales, there was...
So what I would say is this, and this is my speculation, okay, an educated speculation, it could be wrong, I'm just prefacing it. The way I would think about it is as follows. Do we already know that in the 1630s, London and Cambridge were not printing the same text? Do we know that for sure objectively based on what we saw last week in Job 4:6? Yes, okay. My guess, AJ, is that as you go through after the 1638 Cambridge, as you get into the 1640s, the 1650s, people starting to dawn on people possibly that there's incongruencies between the way that Oxford and Cambridge are printing, or sorry, that London and Cambridge are printing. And so when Kilburn writes this piece around 1660, he's addressing a situation that is starting to a situation to which attention is starting to be called. The other thing I will say though is this, I forget the exact year, but at some point Edinburgh starts printing the text too. So it starts getting printed in Scotland. Anything that I've said about any of this so far doesn't take into account anything that might have been going on in the Edinburgh printings. Okay? So the point is, does this get somewhat muddled? All right? So, Professor Norton agrees with Scribner on this point and extends the argument as follows. Quote, Scribner's suggestion that at least one of the name editors must have been involved in both editions seems probable, and he's referring to page 22 of Scribner, though the 1638 editors sometimes disagree with their predecessors and sometimes direct their attention to new aspects of the text, their work is largely of the same sort. Two of the editors named, Boyce and Ward, had been among the original translators, a circumstance that might be taken as giving extra authority to this Cambridge work. So that would be the work of 1638, right? In one way, this might make the 1638 edition the equivalent of an author's own revision of his work. This might well be implied by Kilburn's adjective, authentic, right? Or one might suppose they brought to the revision knowledge of what had originally been intended at various points. The later supposition might have a small degree of truth, but it is of no practical help in judging the worth of individual readings. So he's acknowledging that if that Ward and Boyce being there does have a certain element of official revision to it because they might have been able to speak for what the translators had originally intended. But again, the fact that it's mentioned specifically regarding the 1638, as Mike has just said a moment ago, does seem to have an element of setting that edition apart from the ones that preceded it. Okay? Norton argues that the main editorial principle of both Cambridge editions is a more literal conformity of the text to the original languages. He says, quote, rather, we should remember what the evidence from the 1629 edition has already shown, that these Cambridge editions worked on a subtly different principle from that of the original translators, namely, that whatever minimal changes are possible to align the text more literally with the originals, they should be made. The result is a still more consistent, more literal text. Okay? Now that makes sense with what I've already said about the italics. If they're trying to make sure the italics is accurate and that where there are not words in the original source languages, that they are making sure the words are italicized, that fits with a literal representation of the text in English. Okay. Any questions?
Who authorized the Dr. Paris 1762 edition?
Great question. Paris decides to do it. I'm not aware of any royal authorization other than the text has been 100 and how many years between 1638 and 1762, 141 years or something without updating, so he figures it needs to be gone through again.
So is that mostly like the italics and the
spelling,
of those kind of
spelling, updating punctuation, but as we'll see when we get to 1762, he's also changing readings. I have a video right now on the church YouTube, if you want to look at it, Bart. It's about a verse in Deuteronomy and the weight of how he adds three words to two verses in Deuteronomy that weren't there until 1762. Paris does that in 1762. Okay. So, statistically, the 1638 Cambridge editor supplied 121 readings and 114 spellings of names that became standard according to Dr. Norton. Footnote 15 on page 90 and 91 of a textual history of the King James Bible lists these as follows, okay? Now, I'm going to jump back over here. Now, obviously, folks, look at this. We don't have time to look at every single one of these, okay? We'd be here for the next year just looking at every single one of these, okay? So at the top, or at the bottom of page 4, you have the part of footnote 15. These are the readings that Norton is saying were standardized by the 1638 Cambridge. And then on the top of page 5, under standard spellings, these are related to the spellings of names that became standard through the 1638 Cambridge. Again, I'm not going to go through every single one of those. I don't think we need to do that. I think we can look at a few strategically placed examples and get the point, okay? So we're going to go to page 5. So, recall that in lesson 237, we objectively demonstrated that Cambridge editors were making changes to the text in the lesser editions published throughout the 1630s. And what I mean by lesser editions is I mean the smaller sizes, the quarto and the octavo sizes, and in some cases even the duodecimo sizes, okay? So recall that in lesson 237, we objectively demonstrated that Cambridge editors were making changes to the text in the lesser editions throughout the 1630s. Moreover, I showed from his annotated list of Bibles cataloged in his bibliography on pages 362 and 364, that Professor Norton only looked at the Cambridge folio editions of 1629 and 1638. So let's just revisit that quick. I already have it called up. So here's a 1629 Cambridge folio, okay? Then the next one is a 1629 London quarto, and then notice what happens here after that, okay? London, 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 London. When's the next time he looks at a Cambridge printing? The 1638 folio. Okay? And what I said to you last Sunday is are there minor editions between 1629 and 1638 that Cambridge is printing that are making further changes to the text in between 1629 and 1638 folios? I demonstrated that to you, in my opinion, conclusively in the last video. Okay. So back to the notes. Put another way, he, that's Norton, did not consult any of the minor Cambridge editions between 1629 and 1638. Therefore, some of the changes that Norton catalogs as having originated with the 1638 Cambridge folio edition first appeared in lesser editions throughout the 1630s. Okay? Now, this of course means that Norton's findings need to be taken with a grain of salt and compared against the lesser Cambridge printings for the decade in question in order to gain a wholly accurate picture. So, as thorough as Norton was, is he wholly accurate?
No.
He is not. Why is he not wholly accurate? The reason he is not wholly accurate is because he did not look at Anything Cambridge printed between the folio of 1629 and the folio of 1638. In this intermittent 9 years, Cambridge is printing other lesser editions that are making further changes to the text. So sometimes what happens when you read this stuff is this. Norton will say, well, this change is initiated or inaugurated in the 1638 folio Cambridge. The problem is when you start looking at these intermittent ones, you realize that that's not a true statement, and a lesser edition has already made what?
Change.
The change. Yeah.
Could it be, too, that the because of those changes between those dates, that was almost like a, I don't want to say mandate because now we're getting back into that royal mandate thing, but it couldn't it be they're looking at these changes, and it's almost like they're saying, hey, this is getting out of hand. We're seeing some of these changes, and there's nobody guiding it. Let's stick two officials in there, and maybe that's why Kilburn then says, this is now official because we have two of these people here. This was getting out of hand. People were making changes willy-nilly.
So, it's possible. I don't think we can know for sure, but it's certainly possible. And what is true, beyond doubt, is that the London and the Cambridges did not match. And Cambridge was making changes in between their main folio editions. Those two things are absolutely true. Okay.
Was there no correspondence between the two, or do they have any arguments or disagreements that they?
Oh, Bart, I think the answer to that is I think they did. So if you're the king's printer and you basically have a monopoly on the printing of the text, how are you going to feel about Cambridge University Press entering the market?
Oh, okay.
I'm serious. You're not going to like that, right?
Probably not.
So if Cambridge is now going to be printing a superior text on superior paper with superior binding, et cetera, at a better price.
And superior editors.
And it has a better pedigree as far as the changes that it's made. You can see how there's now going to be a rivalry. Okay. Now, I will say this. I forget the exact year. It's somewhere in the 1630s. Have you heard of the Wicked Bible? The Wicked Bible says in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt commit adultery. There's a print error. Okay. I do not have the receipts right now, but I have read stuff to suggest that error could have been intentional sabotage of the King's Press because of this rivalry developing between Cambridge and London. Now, I'm just throwing that on the table. I've read that in certain places. I don't know if it's true, but it is certainly an interesting little tidbit, regardless. What is not in dispute at all is that there was an edition called the Wicked Bible, and it dates, I believe, from the 1630s.
From London.
Yes, I'm pretty sure it's from London. I can check that, though, and look that up. So, but to your main point, Bart, I do think that there's a burgeoning economic rivalry now between London and Cambridge over the text. And if you're the king's printer, have you spent huge amounts of money to secure the rights to print the text?
More likely.
Yeah, and now somebody else Cambridge is received permission to print it, so it's going to cause a rivalry. Okay.
Now did Scotland get permission also, or who?
So eventually Edinburgh is going to start printing it too.
It is London.
It is a London.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Barker and Martin Lucas.
What year?
1631.
That's right in the neighborhood of what I thought. Now that, so think about, let's just play with that. That makes a lot of sense. If Cambridge's first edition comes out in 1629 and 2 years later, now all of a sudden there's a Wicked Bible coming off the King's Press in London. Yeah, I mean, I could see it. I don't know if it's true, but I could definitely see it. And it definitely makes for an interesting conspiracy theory. But I don't know if it's true or not. Okay? All right, now, so back to the notes. This, of course, means that Norton's findings need to be taken with a grain of salt. Let's look at the next point, okay? So we're going to look at one example. We don't have time to look at 121 examples, all right? Let's consider Norton's first example from footnote 15, Genesis 8:13, as a case in point. In Appendix 9 on page 200, Norton records that the standard reading of 601st year, okay, was established in the 1638 Cambridge edition. So let's look at this. This is Norton's appendix from, this is a screenshot. This is his appendix from the back of the book. Okay? So here's the reference, the 1611 and the sources, the variation, and then he's got some notes over here. Okay? So notice the variation. The 601 year versus the 601st what?
Year.
Now what's better grammar? The 600th and what?
First.
Is better grammar than the 600th and one. Now, is there any substantive difference?
No.
No, but does one seem to maybe read a little bit better than the other? Okay. So, look at the bullet point. First note that there is a difference between the 1611, which reads 601 year, and Bot 1602, which reads 601 year. So the difference is the ETH, 601 versus 601. One. Go to the next page, page 6. So let's look at that. Here's Bod 1602. Here's the, I've tried to call this to your attention. So how is 100 spelled? 100 the way we would spell 100, okay? Look at the 1611. Oh, wait, before we move on, notice though here, 601 year, that's Bod, okay? Look at 1611. In the 601 year. Did everybody see it? Okay. In the next column labeled variation, Norton comments that the reading 601st year originates in 1638. In addition, he notes variations in the spelling of the word hundred in 1616 and 1629. So here's the 1616. Notice how hundred is spelled. The way we would spell it, right? But let's go back to the 1611. How was it spelled? Hundredth, okay? 1616, 601 year. So it's different slightly than the 1611. 1629, 600, not hundredth, and 1 year. Everybody see that? Everybody with me? Yes? No? Maybe so? Okay. So I'm on page 7. So we're right here. So according to Norton, the standard reading of Genesis 8:13 of 601st year, where hundredth is spelled with an ETH at the end, and first year replaced 1 year, was inaugurated in the 1638 Cambridge Folio edition. Okay, so let's look at that. So here's the 1638, and notice the changes. It says 600th with the ETH on the end, and then it says and first year instead of and one what? Year. Is everybody with me? Okay. But is Norton correct regarding the origin of the reading in question? Because remember, he only looked at which editions? He only looked at the Cambridge Folio editions. Okay. But is Norton correct regarding the origin of the reading in question? Remember that Norton did not consult any of the lesser Cambridge printings between 1629 and 1638. Consider the following example from the 1630 Cambridge Quarto and Roman font. So here's a 1630 Cambridge Quarto and Roman font. Notice what it says. 600th and what? First year. Okay? So let's triangulate that. Let's go back to 1629. 1629, 601 what? Year. The 1638 has 601st year, And Norton says this is where the reading originated. But when we look at a 1630 Cambridge quarto, one of the lesser, smaller sizes, notice 600th and first what? So is Norton correct when he says that that reading was inaugurated by the 1638 Cambridge Folio Edition? That is not a correct statement. That reading is first found in a 1630 Cambridge quarto. Not in a six, but he didn't know this because he didn't what?
Okay.
He didn't look at this. Is everybody with me?
Yeah.
Okay. So note at the bottom of page 7 that this is the exact reading that Norton says did not become standard until the 1638 Cambridge Folio Edition. Now, this, I didn't take pictures of all of them, okay? The same reading can be found in the Cambridge printings, can be found in Cambridge printings before 1638. So go to the top of the next page. So I checked all of these. The same reading, 601st year, is in the 1630 quarto, the 1631 quarto. It's in the 1629 Cambridge folio reprint that we talked about last year that was done in 16 what? 35. It's in the 1637 Cambridge quarto, and it's in Roman font, and it's in the 1637 Cambridge quarto black letter font, exactly as it appears in this screenshot from a 1630 Cambridge quarto and Roman font. So does it? So this means then that Norton is not wholly correct about this, because this reading develops in Cambridge printings before the folio edition of 1638. Now, I know this is a lot of stuff to track with, but is everybody with me so far? Any questions? Meanwhile, the following Cambridge editions from the 16th, so as if that's not complicated enough, the following Cambridge editions from the 1630s still contain the reading 601 year. And that would be a 1631 Cambridge quarto H438 and a 1633 Cambridge quarto H474. So, again, is Cambridge printing the text with uniformity in the 1630s?
I mean, they all stay the same, aren't they?
No, because what we see here is all of these Cambridge printings change it to 101st. While these two here still have it as 601.
Oh, okay.
Now this is a typo. Yeah, these have 601 year, whereas the other ones up here they have 601st.
Okay.
Okay.
Now this was just one of the many that were all the other changes all done at the same time, pretty much with Cambridge. Or did they take different steps to get there?
So if you take... Okay, so let me answer your question this way, Bart. Norton says that the following 121 readings became standard in the 1638 Cambridge folio.
Right.
We just looked at one.
Right.
And what we saw in looking at this one is that that's not a true statement.
Right.
Norton missed it. He did not get it wholly accurate. Okay? Now... So here's what I'm going to say. We now have two examples of this happening. We have the example of this happening last week in Job 4:6, and now we have another example of this happening this week in Genesis, what are we looking at here? Genesis 8:13? Is that right? Okay. So now, Bart, we have two examples of this happening, okay? So what would I say about that? I would say that every single, in order to know for sure, you got to take all 121 of those and you got to check them against all the other ones to know for sure. And I'll be honest with you, I haven't done that because I do try to have somewhat of a life. Okay. But it's an important observation to make, right? So look at my next point, starting here with this survey. This survey of Cambridge printings from the 1630s leads to the following conclusions. Number one, as good as Norton's work is, it is not complete and needs to be fact-checked. Okay? Because Norton only looked at the 1629 and 1638 Cambridge folio editions, his work overlooks what was happening in the lesser Cambridge editions during this period, the 1630s. Therefore, Norton's work needs to be independently verified before one can rely exclusively or definitively upon his findings. Now I have to say, Bart, just to be fully transparent, this was disappointing to me. To realize that Norton had missed this stuff. Because I was operating under the assumption, reading his book, that he knew what he was talking about. And I got to be careful here, because I would say Norton knows more about it than most people, for sure. And I'm Norton reliant. But even when I get into it, I realize that because he didn't check all of them, some of what he says isn't what? It's not accurate. Okay? And then the second thing is the observation that Cambridge was unevenly printing the text in the 1630s. So now you have differences between Cambridge printings and sizes, not to mention the difference between the ones coming out of London. Okay? So now that's what we're going to look at. A comparison of the London copies during the same period only serves to complicate matters further. Consider the following comparison. Okay? So these are London's. Notice here's the first one. 601 year. 100 spelled like this. Versus 101 year. Okay? A 1630 quarto and in black letter and a 1630 quarto in Roman have it this way. A 1635 London duodecimo, H501, and a 1637 London octavo, H517, have it this way. So these disagree with each other, and they disagree from Cambridge. So is there any uniformity in the text here? No. Now, I would say the substance is the same, but the details are not what? The same. And I'll also say this just as a, see what you guys think, okay? If you're talking English grammar, what's the better way to say this? 601 year or 601st year? So when they change one to first, is that a printer error? Well, you can go back and show that it said 1 year all the way back to the 1602 Bishop's Bible. Or when they change one to first year, is that a stylistic change of an editor to make that sound better in English? It is, to me, it is not a print error. It is an editorial what? Change. It's a stylistic revision to make it read better in English. It's not changing the substance. It's not substantively altering the doctrinal content of the verse. But it's not verbatimly identical to the way it was. Yeah.
It also points to those that are KJV 1611 only. I mean, they don't just say King James only, they say 1611. There is no way they're reading the 1611. I'm sorry.
I would agree. And there's no way that anybody that stands in a pulpit today and reads a 1769 like I'm going to do when I preach is reading only and exclusively only all of the editorial decisions of the King James translators without any later things going, influence going on. It's just not true. It's just not true. And I just don't understand why there are some people that refuse to admit it. It's just objectively not true. Okay? So let's finish this up. We got a few minutes left. So, bottom of page 8. What are the major takeaways from all this? First, it seems clear that the text of the AV was not being printed with uniformity by either Cambridge or London during the 1630s. That's obvious, right? Second, not only do the Cambridge printings differ from other Cambridge printings, same for London printings, they diverge from the London printings. So London disagrees with London, Cambridge disagrees with Cambridge, and London and Cambridge disagree with each other. That's the point there. Okay? So between this lesson and lesson 237, we have now observed this phenomenon for two verses. Job 4:6 and Genesis 8:13. How many of the 121 readings noted by Norton in footnote 15 would this apply to? Well, I do not know the exact number. I suspect the number would be quite high. Possibly. That's a supposition. I don't know for sure. But I think it would be higher than maybe you might realize if you actually went and back-checked all this, okay? Again, how long did Cambridge and London continue to print different renditions of the text? We know from the last two lessons that it spanned the decade of the 1630s at a minimum and possibly, probably longer. Okay? Exactly how long remains undetermined at this point. We just don't know. It's underdetermined. Of the 121 readings and 14 spellings of names that became standard listed in footnote 15 of Norton, only a handful were later rejected in favor of something else. Professor Norton records these in footnote 16 on page 91. So you can see it's far fewer than what had been accepted in footnote 15 as standard readings and spellings. Keeping in mind that the following statistics do not account for the minor Cambridge printings of the 1630s, Norton states the following regarding the total number of changes made by Cambridge editors in the 1629 and 1638 folio editions. He says, quote, "If we combine these figures with those from 1629, the early Cambridge editor supplied 591 standard readings and spellings, 60% from the 1629. That's a statistical analysis, to which I would have to say, is it somewhat off because he didn't check the minor ones, okay? While these numbers might falsely attribute edits to a particular Cambridge edition, 1629 or 1638, they are probably fairly accurate as it pertains to the total number of revisions made by the editors of the university press." And the reason I say they're still fairly accurate, because even if the edit is coming from a minor Cambridge printing, is it still coming from a Cambridge printing? Okay? So, we will continue our consideration of a 1638 Cambridge folio edition in the next lesson. I got just a little bit more to say about this that I want to cover in the next lesson. So we are running short.